Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This week in the room, I'm talking to Ian Dale, the LBC presenter, podcaster, publisher, and writer. We'll hear how Ian pursued a career in politics.
In retrospect, I think I would have been a nightmare as an MP in Westminster. I think I would have been a bit of a maverick. I think I would have found it very difficult to toe the party line on a lot of things.
How he turned his hand to publishing.
And I kept getting people coming into the shop asking for a particular type of book on a subject. And there wasn't one. And in the end, I thought, well, why isn't there one? If I've got 40 or 50 people asking for the same book and there isn't one, maybe somebody ought to write it.
And how he thinks we all have a duty to improve the standard of debate in this country.
Just in our everyday life, I think we've lost the ability to understand that the other person not only has another different point of view, but is entitled to a different point of view.
Anyway, the first room I put Ian into was as David Davis's chief of staff in 2005, as the Conservative leadership battle began.
When I joined David, who I'd known for 15 years, who was a very good friend, and I'd just lost the election in North Norfolk, and I didn't quite know what I was going to do. And I knew that his chief of staff then was leaving. It was actually Tracy Crouch, who's now a member of Parliament. And I was remember, I think it was the Saturday or Sunday after the election, I was driving out of Norfolk over the Suffolk border and he rang. And he commiserated with my result and I knew that he was going to stand for the leadership. And I sort of half jokingly said to him, oh, well, I can come and be your chief of staff. And he said, why, would you be interested in that? I said, yeah, if the money's right. Anyway, 2 days later, he'd raised the money. And so I said, OK, let's do it. Now, I thought I knew what a chief of staff did. But in retrospect, I didn't. And my big mistake was not to effectively lay the law down right from the beginning, because he had a campaign group of MPs, Derek Conway, Andrew Mitchell, Damian Green. They were, I suppose, the leading ones, Paul Goodman, Nick Herbert. But I rapidly discovered that because I didn't have the letters MP after my name, I was kind of considered not to be one of them, even though I'd known them all for quite a long time. And I didn't assert my authority right from the beginning, which I should have. Now, I don't think me doing that would have necessarily changed the result. But it was the worst 6 months of my working life. I have to say, I didn't enjoy it at all. I was a round peg in a square hole. And certainly as time went on, it became, well, once it was clear that David wasn't going to win, it became very unenjoyable.
What that round peg, square hole thing then, why is? Because you're a political animal. Yeah, not so much now you've kind of pulled away from frontline politics, but you do great political interviews. Why did you feel that? Because you've been a Conservative for how many years? Since from school days, practically?
Since I was about 1978, I think I effectively became a Conservative. Why didn't it work? I think it was because I wasn't a campaign strategist, although my own campaign in North Norfolk, I'd obviously run that. And people look at the result and think, well, it must have been a pretty terrible campaign. Actually, it was a very good campaign, but I was up against Norman Lamb, who was a brilliant campaigner himself, very good local MP. And it just didn't gel, the whole thing. It wasn't sort of interpersonal relationships particularly, though I do remember a particularly aggressive row with Andrew Mitchell once, where I ended up nearly pinning him up against the wall. It was because a lot of the MPs that we were dealing with felt a little bit bullied by the campaign leaders, Derek Conway and Andrew Mitchell, I suppose you could say were responsible for that. And I should have stepped in and said, look, do you realise what you're doing? You're really damaging things. But we were so far ahead at the time We had so many more MPs than any other candidate supporting us. So, I mean, if I'd intervened then and said, look, I think you're doing all this wrong, I'm not sure it would have made any difference whatsoever. But I could kind of see that there was a lot of resentment being built up among MPs, and all they needed was a little bit of an excuse to drift away. And of course, David Cameron, then at the party conference, gave them that excuse.
Talk about MP. Would you have been a good MP, do you think?
I always wanted to be an MP. In fact, I wanted to be either an MP or a radio presenter. An MP was the thing that I thought would be easiest to do, actually, because I always thought the media was very difficult to break into for someone like me. I think I would have been a really good constituency MP. I loved all of the constituency side, all the casework, meeting people, visiting companies, hospitals, schools. Absolutely loved all of that. In retrospect, I think I would have been a nightmare as an MP in Westminster. I think I would have been a bit of a maverick. I think I would have found it very difficult to toe the party line on a lot of things. And therefore, I probably wouldn't have progressed very far in terms of being a minister. Now, when I stood, I wasn't particularly interested in being a minister. But looking back, the only way you can really change things is to be a minister. And I think I would have found that quite frustrating if I hadn't been able to progress. I always wanted to be Secretary of State for Transport, which a lot of people think shows a remarkable lack of ambition. But you can actually do things. You can change things. You can make things better. You can probably make things worse as well. But I always wanted to do that job. And if I ever ended up in the House of Lords, which, let's face it, isn't going to happen, being a junior transport minister, I think, would be an absolute dream job.
What do you think? Because you and I, Ian, will remember the visionaries, the real characters, in a sense, in the House of Commons. I don't know, and you might disagree, but I don't think we have the same level of characters. I don't know if we've got the same level of integrity. Do you think the current batch of all parties, Ian, do you think that they're up to scratch?
Well, you and I have to be very careful here because we are at risk of indulging in old Gittism in the, oh, it wasn't like that in my day.
You leave the back door open.
And I think if we were having this conversation in the mid-1980s, I'm sure there would have been people then who said, well, you've got all these people in Thatcher's cabinet. They're not very good, are they? They're not like it was when Harold Macmillan was prime minister. However, I think you're right. I think this cabinet, this shadow cabinet, are the weakest in living memory. We're recording this in the middle of December, and yesterday there was a cabinet meeting where Boris Johnson outlined his effective plans for a no-deal free trade agreement. And apparently there wasn't a murmur of dissent around the cabinet table. And I'm thinking, well, there must have been somebody who was expressing concerns about this, but apparently not. Now, that was the opposite during Theresa May's time, when literally everybody seemed to be dissenting. There are really good people in Parliament, but I'm afraid we've got the Parliament that we deserve, because we now... don't like it when MPs have any outside interests. We don't like it that they earn £81,000 a year. So therefore, you've got a very restricted group of people becoming politicians now. Effectively, there are a lot of more than ever career politicians, people who've only ever been in politics. Now, there's nothing wrong with having some of those, but there are far too many at the moment. You look around the cabinet table and there are too many on the cabinet and shadow cabinet who've really not achieved an awful lot apart from being in politics. So I think it's quite dangerous when you build a generation of political geeks as your representatives. You do need to have a much wider spread of people.
Do you think that accounts for the kind of disconnect between the public and politicians? And you know, we've always kind of joked about the hated occupations, the estate agents and the like, and politicians. But it seems now more them and us. That might just be a perception from me, but it just feels like we can't reach out to them the way that maybe we did in the past. Again, old gitterish.
Well, if that is the perception, I think it's entirely wrong. It's so much easier to get in touch with a politician now than it ever was when I first worked in the Commons in the 1980s, when you could literally just write a letter. And I can remember picking up when the Sunday trading debate was going on in 1986, we would literally get sackfuls of letters. Well, of course, today it's all done by email. People do write letters, but most of them are by email. And you know what it's like when you send an email to somebody, you expect a reply almost instantaneously. And if you don't get one, you start thinking, well, that's outrageous. How rude. Well, an MP, I'm afraid, cannot answer every single email personally. Now, they've got staff to do that for them. You can contact MPs on Twitter. You can have debates with MPs on Twitter now sometimes. Facebook, you've got all sorts of ways of getting in touch with your MP rather than just turning up at their constituency surgery, which they hold every couple of weeks. And I've never bought into this idea that politicians are out of touch, because they do their constituency surgeries. They go on visits to schools, hospitals, companies. They spend a lot more time in their constituencies than most people realise, the good ones do anyway. So the problem is that they're absolutely terrible at selling or marketing what they do. So people look at the chamber of the House of Commons and see it half empty, and they imagine that their MP is having a sherbet in one of the bars. Well, not true. They're probably in a committee somewhere which isn't being televised. But you try and explain that to people and their eyes glaze over. And I try and stick up for the profession of politics and politicians, because they do get a very hard time in the media, too much, actually. And I try and give them a chance to explain to people what they do. And it's important that we understand what they do.
I want to move you into another room now. Because you're quite the writer. You've written a lot of books. I didn't know, and I'll talk about this later on, but West Ham and Norwich. I didn't know about those books. So we'll talk about that.
You have done your research.
Yeah. What I wanted to get into, before we talk about writing, because you were a publisher before those, and again, was it mainly political sort of literature you published?
Well, I fell into publishing by accident. I was running owned a political bookstore in Westminster, which was the Politicos. It started in 1997. And I kept getting people coming into the shop asking for a particular type of book on a subject. And there wasn't one. And in the end, I thought, well, why isn't there one? If I've got 40 or 50 people asking for the same book and there isn't one, maybe somebody ought to write it. So I started a publishing company alongside the bookshop. Knew nothing about publishing, but I thought, well, it can't be that difficult. Little did I know. So we started publishing. I think we did 5 books in our first year, 10 in our second, 20 in our third, and so it went on. And then I sold it. One of my big mistakes, I sold it to another publishing company, Methuen, in 2003, because I had no money really to develop it. And at that point, didn't really know a lot of people who had money. So I thought the only way that this can really survive or expand is to sell it. As it turned out, Methuen just ran it into the ground. And then about 5 or 6 years later, I started a political magazine called Total Politics. And again, I kept thinking, well, that big publishers aren't publishing political books because they inevitably don't sell as well as normal nonfiction. So I thought there's a real gap in the market here. So I started Biteback. And we ended up publishing 80 to 100 books a year, most of them current affairs based. But again, we thought the only way to expand was to widen our range. So I hired Jeremy Robson, who had published my first book back in 1998. He was in more general commercial publishing, again, nonfiction. We never published novels. And so we expanded our range. So he handled that side. I still handled all the political side. And I got a real kick out of publishing books that I thought nobody else would have published, but some of them were actually quite successful. Damien McBride's book, Power Trip, best book I ever published. Brilliant writer. That sold, I don't know, 40 or 50,000 copies, which for us was absolutely massive, because a lot of political books only sell a couple of thousand. So I enjoyed it, but I left in 2018. I've been doing it for 10 years. And my media career had really taken off, and I just got a 3-day-a-week show on CNN. Something had to give. And I wasn't bored as such, but I could feel that it probably needed to end there. And I had a bit of a disagreement over the future of the company. Again, I thought given the state of the publishing industry, we should be selling it to a bigger company, make it an imprint of HarperCollins or Simon & Schuster or whatever. But our principal shareholder was Michael Ashcroft, who was incredibly supportive right throughout, but he didn't want to sell. And so I felt, well, that sort of makes my position a bit untenable because he's rejected my advice on that. And there was a few other things as well. It all sort of coalesced together. And I thought, no, this is the time to leave. So that's what happened.
You have been a timings person, haven't you? Things have kind of almost coalesced into you making decisions. You know, your burgeoning media career was kind of, I suppose, might have influenced the publishing sort of decision as well, that things have kind of not fallen into place, because certainly in this game, things don't always fall into place, always fall the other way, usually. But that seems to have been a thing for you as well.
Well, you have to reinvent yourself from time to time. And there have been several things. I mean, people look at me now and think, well, you do a huge amount in the media, you've had your publishing company, you write books, you appear on television, so therefore you must be really successful. But it wasn't always like that. And I mean, as I said, the David Davies thing wasn't a success. I mean, if that had been a success, I could have ended up working in Downing Street, which had been quite nice, I suppose. I was part of an internet TV thing in 2007, the first political internet TV station, but it was 10 years ahead of its time. And people weren't watching things on computer screens in those days, really. So that only lasted 18 months. So you constantly have to reinvent yourself. And I suppose I have done that. I also have a bit of a short attention span. normally, I do things for about 5 years and I sort of get itchy feet. I mean, I've been at LBC now 10 years, yeah. And I'm slightly surprised that I haven't sort of got itchy feet on that. And I genuinely haven't. I still love doing it as much as I did the first day. So you can't stand still. When something bad happens, you either view it as a threat and just you wallow in a slough of despond, or you think, okay, well, that didn't work out. Let's start again. Let's do something else. And luckily for me, Politico's in 1997, that only started because I'd run a lobbying company with a guy that I'd worked with before for 6 years, and we had a falling out, and that ended up with me leaving. So there I was. I had a sort of Audi Cabriolet as a company car. I was earning 60 grand a year, which in those days was a good whack, or still is in these days, I suppose. And so, again, considered a great success. And then the next day, I was unemployed. And I nearly ended up doing what people always sort of, I suppose, joke about a bit. I seriously thought about working at Tesco's on the tills, because I was planning to do Politico's, but that was inevitably going to take 6 months to a year to work out, and I had no income. So you have to make the best out of a bad job sometimes.
Let's move to writing then. What kind of writer are you? Are you reluctant? Are you seeing the white page as a big, big demand and going, all right, I've got to get this done. You've got deadlines to meet. Do you enjoy writing?
No, I never have. I never have enjoyed writing, which is ironic considering it's a much bigger part of what I do than it used to. You say I've written a lot of books. I've actually only written two books. I've edited about 40, but editing a book is not writing a book. I wrote a short polemic on the NHS in 2015, and then Why Can't We All Just Get Along, which came out in August this year. But I know that I can't write like Boris Johnson or Michael Gove, people like that. I just can't. And so whenever even now, after all these years of writing a hell of a lot of columns for newspapers, magazines, whenever I press the send button, I expect it to come back saying, this is shit, start again. It never has. Nobody's ever done that, whether they might have thought it. I don't know.
That's so surprising. And I think, Ian, as well, that will be a wee bit of help for struggling writers is, you know, because everybody, even at your level, everybody goes through that horrible feeling of nothing's quite good enough.
Yeah, I have a real sense of, well, I was going to say I have a sense of imposter syndrome about my writing. If I'm honest, I have quite a lot of imposter syndrome about a lot of things, because I mean, I wasn't born into doing this sort of thing. I wasn't born into politics like so many people are. I didn't go to Oxford. I didn't go to Cambridge. I didn't go to a public school. And it's always been a little bit of a struggle for me to break into those kind of areas where there were people that I know and people who are friends who just seem to have waltzed through life because of what they were born into. That wasn't me. I was born into a farming family. And I was literally, as Neil Kinnock might say, I was the first Dale in 1,000 generations not to go into farming. Thereby, there's another story. But so I've never really been confident about my writing. And when HarperCollins asked me to do the Why Can't We All Just Get Along book, and I've never said this to anyone else before, I genuinely was in two minds. I thought, can I really do this? Can I write a book as opposed to writing a 1,000-word article? And in the end, I thought, well, you'll never know if you don't give it a try. And I mean, I'm glad I did do it. I tend to write as I speak, which in some ways is a strength and in some ways is a weakness. I think I can write to appeal to people who aren't particularly interested in politics. I can write about politics in a way that is accessible to people who are not political geeks. And that's what I try and do on the radio. I don't do a radio show just aimed at people as interested in politics as me. The biggest compliments I get are from parents who say, I just wanted you to know that you have inspired my 14-year-old daughter to get interested in politics. And I think, well, my job is done then if I'm able to do that.
Let's talk about the book, because it's a great read. And I'm glad you said that about you write the way you speak, because I've listened to you so long on the radio. And that's the voice I can hear. And that's terrific, because it's quite hard to develop. You know what it's like in radio, to develop that voice, to develop what you want to sound like. And it's the same with your writing. Why can't we all just get along and shout less? And I just wonder, in light of what we were talking earlier on, Ian, about where politics are. Do you think we'd need to develop a listening ear as constituents? Do we need to develop a listening ear, not interviewers, but just us as people, to listen to arguments put to us?
Well, I don't think there's ever a downside to listening. And you say you weren't really talking about interviewers, but I think it applies to interviewers as well. Often, and I think this particularly applies in very big media organisations, they have so many producers that producers produce a list of questions for the interviewer, and therefore the interviewer goes through them one by one. It doesn't really matter what the interviewee has said, they just go through their questions. Well, I think that you get much more out of someone if you have a conversation with them. You then stand the risk of being accused of being a soft interviewer, because you're not haranguing somebody. And we all know the interviewers that do that. And sometimes it's justified. And I've done it in the past, but only if I think that I'm having the wool pulled over my eyes, or if somebody is really just trying to spin a line. That gets my blood flowing. And therefore, I will become more aggressive in an interview. But generally, and this is where I think the return of the long form interview in podcasts is a really great thing. You've got podcasts like Matt Faure's Political Party, Nick Robinson's Political Thinking. I mean, I do one, an interview podcast, All Talk. And that was based on a show I did at the Edinburgh Festival, where I would have a guest on stage for an hour. And audiences really like that. And I don't understand why some of the bigger media organisations don't get that. It's not all about the four-minute soundbitey interview, or it shouldn't be. Obviously, in a news programme, like a breakfast show, inevitably you can't do half-hour interviews, or very rarely. But more widely, you ought to be able to do that. And that's the great thing about what I do on LBC, and that if I want to do an hour-long interview or phone in with one individual, I can do that. Now, going back to what you asked about listening, just in our everyday life, I think we've lost the ability to understand that the other person not only has another different point of view, but is entitled to a different point of view. And if we're trying to debate with somebody, surely we have to not only accept that they have the right to a different point of view, but we ought to try to understand where they're coming from. Because if we do that, then we can marshal our own arguments against the stance that they're taking. And you saw that this, I mean, in the Brexit debate, where on both sides, if you were an ultra-Remainer, you thought Brexiteers were delusional, stupid, racist, thick, whatever. If you're a hard Brexiteer, you considered Remainers to be traitors because they were selling out to a foreign power. And never the twain shall meet. And that's where it got so divisive. And I can see it starting again with all of the thing about no deal at the end of the year, where entrenched positions are being retaken, old arguments are being refought. And to be honest, I'm sick of it. I stay out of it now on Twitter because I cannot, if ever I tweet now about anything related to Brexit, I might as well not look at my Twitter feed for the next 24 hours. And it shouldn't be like that.
You talk about there about the long form interview. The one that got me hooked onto political interviews was Brian Walden, who you'll remember on LWT. And he would have somebody.
I applied for a job on his program.
Did
once
you?
In 1987, I think it was. David Aronovich was the head producer, and he interviewed me. And it was one of those interviews that you knew wasn't going well right from the beginning. I keep meaning to ask him, well, he won't remember it at all. But that was one of those occasions where I thought if I'd been to a public school, I would have stood much more of a chance.
From that point here, I want to move us in then to your it might even be your happy place, your happy room, your radio studio, which is your house at the moment, is your room at the moment. But tell me about if you're at work at LBC, Ian, what does a day look like? Because whenever I hear you, I used to do 4 till 7. Farage was on before you, 6 till 7. Then I would hear you on the way home. And it always seems like there's something kind of breaking. So I know what it's like behind the scenes. You've set up the program, you've got the guests, and then things happen. You obviously love that, but tell me about a normal day for you and the setup for the program.
Well, let's go back to pre-COVID times because that was normal. I like to get into LBC around 3 hours before the program starts, whereas nowadays I don't. I often get in only an hour before the program starts for. I'm type 2 diabetic. I go in on the train, but I don't want to mix with anybody if I can avoid it. I did 4 months of broadcasting from home, which I actually really enjoyed, but I was keen to get back into the studio. And you described it as my happy room, and you don't know how true that is because I feel completely at home there. And the LBC studio compared to other stations is pretty space age. And we've now got a new studio at 4 Milbank, which is effectively a television studio. And you feel in total control of events when you're sitting behind that desk. For the older listeners who remember Davros in Doctor Who, you've got this sort of control panel, and it just gives you that sense of confidence. And you're looking through the glass to your producers, the producer-presenter relationship, you can't describe how important it is unless you've actually been involved with it. And you, as a presenter, you want a producer who gets you, who understands what you're about, who understands your motivations. And I've been really lucky, more or less all through my 10 years at LBC, that I've always had producers that I've got on with and who understand me, and particularly the two that I've got at the moment. Although they're quite young, they totally get what I'm trying to do. And it's just, it does feel like home. And because I've been there, I never thought I'd be there for 10 years. I have to say, every time my contract comes up for renewal, I'm convinced that they're going to let me go. But that hasn't happened yet. But it will happen one day because radio is a fairly ruthless industry. Yes. Now, I've always performed. I get the big guess and my figures have always been really good. But at some point, they will want to make a change. And there is a sense of dread about that day because you are literally, as John Knott would say, here today, gone tomorrow. Often radio presenters don't even get a chance to say goodbye to their audience. I mean, that's the one thing I really hope I do get a chance. And it'll be a very weepy goodbye, I imagine, as well. But I hope that doesn't happen anytime soon.
I'll give you a heads up on that. I've been let go several times in my career for various reasons, Ian, but I grieved because I missed, and it's great to hear you talking in the studio, I missed the tactile thing of actually opening faders and connecting things. And I miss that relationship when a really good producer just says what they need to say in your ear, all right? They don't have to produce a great big cue.
Yeah.
And say,
well, that is absolutely right. And a good producer makes you a better presenter than you really are. Yeah. One of my best producers was Matt Harris, who now works on Newsnight. And he was actually my first producer. And then when I took over the Drive Time slot in 2013, he came back and produced that for the first 3 years. And he just had this knack of thinking of the question that a politician would find most difficult. And what he also did, and he would say it in my ear, and what he would also do is make me ask it again, because sometimes, I mean, I used to, this doesn't happen any longer, but particularly when you're interviewing someone that you know, just as a human being, there is that slight reluctance to really go in for the kill sometimes. Yeah. And he knocked that out of me. And I mean, we would have one, I mean, there was occasionally huge rows. A live radio studio is a volatile setting. And I do laugh at sometimes when people say, oh, there's so much bullying in the media. Well, you should listen to some of the rows that producers and presenters have together. It's not about bullying. It's just these things happen in a live radio environment. I mean, there was one time I remember where he said in my ear, right, can you just announce this or say this, which I then did. But he hadn't heard because somebody was talking to him, I suppose. And he then, I think he'd been having a bad day, and he just said, almost screamed in my ear, just say that, do your effing job. And I said, don't you effing blind you. And then the C word was exchanged. And this was like 6:15, and we literally didn't speak to each other for the rest of the hour. And I just walked out the studio at the end and didn't say a word. And then he phoned me about 11 o'clock and we sort of kissed and made up. Yeah. But these things happen. There's no malice intended. Everyone understands we're all adults, but sometimes, I mean, we've become a bit snowflakey about these things. Yeah. Sometimes if it's like every day where a presenter is bullying a producer or even a producer bullying a presenter, that is not acceptable. And I have seen examples of that happen. It's great fun, particularly as you said at the beginning, when there's breaking news. I love a breaking news story. And of course, when I moved from, when I was moved from Drive Time to the evening show, which, I mean, I did wonder whether I should do. Of course, little did I know that all of the Brexit stuff was going to dominate the first 18 months. And of course, I was on air at exactly the right time for parliamentary votes, for breaking news. Yeah. Virtually every night. And we would do some programmes live from Westminster in our tent on College Green. And it was incredibly exciting.
You're a podcaster now as well, several podcasts, but I'm interested.
Six.
Yes, I was going to say.
Too many podcasts, Mr. Dale, too many podcasts.
I'm interested in the one, of course, you struck up with Jackie Smith. Tell me about the relationship. Yeah. For the Many is the name of the podcast, For the Many Pod. Tell me about that relationship. How did you build that up with Jackie?
Well, when I used to do my blog, which is really, I suppose, when I became slightly famous in like 2006 to 2010, she was Home Secretary for the latter part of that period. And then when she had her expenses issues, I can remember writing some pretty bad things about her. And then I was commissioned by GQ to write a 3,000-word profile of David and Ed Miliband. This was in 2009, I think, or maybe 2008. And so I went to spend the day with David Miliband at the Foreign Office. And he was speaking at an event, and he said, oh, Jackie Smith's coming. I thought, oh, right, okay. Anyway, much to my horror, he beckoned me out of the audience to introduce me to her. And she was very polite, but there was I could sense a certain reserve. And then when I started Total Politics, I used to do long form Q&A interviews with politicians. And after she resigned, more in hope than expectation, I contacted her and said, look, I'd really like to do an interview with you. Anyway, she said yes. And we just hit it off. We got on like a house on fire. I think she and I spent 3 hours together. And when I wrote the interview up, and I think she regarded that as her first step towards, maybe not rehabilitation is the wrong word, but her first step back into the public eye. And I asked him quite personal questions, all of which he answered quite directly. And then Sky said to me, because I used to do late night pay-per-views, who would you like to be your partner this week? And I said, oh, why don't you ask Jackie Smith? And there an on-screen partnership was born. And we did that for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years. And then I had the idea of starting the podcast after I did a similar thing with Sheila Fogarty during the 2017 general election campaign. I was going to do it with Sheila, but the timings didn't work. So I asked Jackie if she wanted to do it. So the podcast is actually just 3 years old now. So I think we've done 230 episodes, and it's become a bit of a thing, and it's developed over time. It's not, people imagine two political people just talk about politics in a very serious way. Well, Ronnie, if you've listened to it, you'll know that it's not quite like that.
It's not at all. It's not, and it's very funny. And Jackie's actually, really sharp as well. And she's always been, sharp and that. So, Ian, I've kept you away from whatever you have to do. My last one, I've got to go back to West Ham and Norwich City, all right? Mm. You wrote two books about the kind of history. Are you a big football fan?
I am. I'm a West Ham season ticket holder. Not that I've been since February, I think. I started life as a Manchester United supporter, which, coming from Essex, was perfectly natural, I suppose. Yeah. That's where most of their supporters live. But then they got relegated, and I think I was 10 years old or something like that, and the shame of supporting a relegated side was too much. So my best friend at the time supported West Ham, so I supported West Ham. And what a great decision that's proved to be, rather than supporting Manchester United. And Norwich, I was at university in Norwich. My mum comes from Norfolk. And Norwich have always kind of been my second team. So I did the book on West Ham, and then the publisher said, do you want to do another one on a different club? And I thought, well, I know a bit about Norwich, not as much as West Ham, but I really enjoyed doing that book. It was great doing the research. And I was hoping that they would continue the series, but unfortunately not, because I would have quite liked to have done a few more.
Were you a bit of a player? Did you play football?
No.
You look like a centre-half.
I enjoyed playing. We had a sort of little football pitch at home, and I just didn't have the skills. I played in goal quite a lot, and I did pull off a few good saves, I suppose, but I never played for a team. I was never good at team sports. Hockey was the only one. I used to play centre forward as a real goal hanger. I was quite good at hockey, but no, my sports are golf and tennis in terms of playing. Right.
We did say about your happy room, what would be the room, apart from the radio studio, who would you like to be in the room with in your happy room?
I suppose, because both of my parents have died in the last 10 years, I'd love to spend just an hour with both my parents in our sitting room in the house that we grew up in Ashton, near Saffron Walden. I had such an idyllic childhood. I had the most, I'm going to cry in a minute.
Yeah,
I had the most amazing parents, and I'd give anything for that.
Yeah, I think we all would, just to have that hour of just going back over the good stuff they did, the great life they gave us.
And you think of all of the things that you didn't ask them when they're gone. I'm quite into my family tree, and I've traced it back to, on one side of the family, going back to about 1500. And on the other side of the family, I thought I had confirmed that we're descendants of Robbie Burns, but I still have yet to verify that 100%. It all depends on one person who's got named James Armour, because my
Jean Armour
was
obviously his
wife.
Yes.
Well, my auntie, my dad's sister, that is her name, Jean Armadale. And she always said, well, we're descended from Robbie Burns. And I never managed to prove it, but the internet is a wonderful thing. And one person that I consulted, he went back and did all of that. But her father was called James Armour, but there were two James Armours in the same town. And it depends which one of them was really his father as to whether we are descended. So when I retire, which I frankly never think I will, but if I do ever retire, that's what I'm going to try and make my life's mission, to prove it one way or the other.
Well, just to let you know, I'm from Mauchline in Ayrshire, Ian, right in the heart of, I'm from,
whoa,
Robert that, Burns that did all these.
That is exactly where my family come from.
Well, I was brought up in Mauchline. There's Jean Armour Drive, there's Pussy Nancy's Pub, and Mosgiel Farm, where Burns did a lot of his writing, his courting. So it would be nice if you've got a Mauchline connection. That would be great.
Well, I know that certainly, because the Dale family were in that area, sort of around sort of New Cumnock, for decades, hundreds of years. And my grandfather moved down to first Consett and then Essex in the early 1900s. So I've got all of the addresses where all of them used to live.
Wow.
So at some point, a good friend of mine, Sally Hendry, who's married to the former Tory MP Charles Hendry, they now run some big estate in the area. I think it's only about 20 miles from there, the Blair Estate. So I'm going to go and stay with them for a week at some point and then go and visit all of these places, which I suspect is going to be a bit emotional as well.
Ian, I've got to say as well, well done on the pronunciation of New Cumnock. Some people go New Cumnock. You put the two together, New Cumnock. It is one word, but it's two. So you are truly...
Well, you see, it's the blood coming through the centuries, isn't it?
My thanks to Ian Dale. Next week, I'll be talking to Chris Akabusi, the Olympic legend, gold medalist, and now motivational speaker.
And it's shaking loose and it's vibrant, and you can see the quads pumping, and I'm just jazzed up, and we're ready to make history.
I'll see you next time in the room.